Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 6, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Driven, Complicating Cars. Let's listen in.
I'm Jim Farrell. This is a session on called Driven, the Moral Ecology of Cars. And it's part of 2 weeks of talks and conversations that I'm involved in having to do with the moral ecology of everyday life. And I, with the great turnaround that we've had this Saturday, I can't remember how many of you were at the first talk that I did on Monday, but I'll assume for the moment that not all of you were there and just say a few words about what this general thing is that I'm doing. I teach a class introducing American Studies at St. Olaf, and originally, I started teaching that class the way that American Studies was founded, which was a combination of history and literature, and found that that worked fine. And then we had somebody come and evaluate the program, and they said, well, that's nice, but it's about 30 years out of date, since American Studies now does sociology, anthropology, political science, and that sort of thing. And so then I thought, well, I'll introduce students to the theory and method of all these different disciplines. And so I had a course on the theory and method of 6 or 7 different disciplines. And it was incredibly dull. It was so boring that even I was bored, because you know, you're working with theoretical stuff and concepts and stuff like that. And so then I decided that rather than spend my time focusing on theory, I would try to see what theory could do and spend my time doing that, and invite the students to be really co-teachers with me, so that we do all kinds of things in this class that are designed to let students see their world and to interpret it on their own. So on day one of the class, I do just a general introductory sort of thing. I give them all 50 cents, tell them to buy a Coke and come back on day two. And on day two, we interpret a Coke can. That's the whole class for day two. It takes more than an hour to interpret a Coke can, but we just sort of make a go at it in 1 hour. And then, since we're at St. Olaf and we have a fairly large campus, one of the assignments that they get is to do a cultural geography of St. Olaf College campus. Why are all the things where they are? Why do we have lawns? Why do we have sidewalks? Why does the road go where it goes? What are the parking lots doing there? Why do the buildings look like they're made of gray limestone? All of that sort of thing. So they have to figure out the answers to those kinds of questions. Probably the most elegant assignment that I've blundered into in the course of teaching this class is one that I call the American Studies Museum. And this involves the students just looking around campus and finding an artifact. Like they might pick this magic marker here and say, okay, and what I require them to do then is write a 15-page paper on this artifact saying, what does this artifact tell you about American culture? And then once they've written the 15-page paper, I have them condense it to 1 page, single-spaced. And then we put this artifact and the 1-page condensation in one of the rooms of the student center that we get for a day right before Thanksgiving. And we actually do open up an American Studies Museum, and people can come in and read about their own culture in ways that they've not thought about it at all. And then the final assignment is to do a book together, where everybody writes a chapter, and the title of the book every year is Habits of My Heart, A Day in the Life. And what we try to do is simply interpret the things that we do every day. And each student takes one thing that an average student might do. So a student might write about taking a shower, or going to chapel, or going to a class, or visiting a professor in office hours, or eating at the CAF. One of the interesting things about eating the calf at St. Olaf is that there are two lines entering the calf, and one line is always longer than the other line, which has always seemed just peculiar to me that this could be the case. So students have done some research on this for me and have discovered that there's a cool line and a nerd line. And the cool line is the longer line, because apparently you want to be cool if you're a college student, and the nerd line is a different line. And the cool line tends people tend to dress more for the cool line because it's more of a display kind of thing. The nerd line tends to be more practical, people who just are going to the cafeteria to eat and not for all of the display functions that a cafeteria can provide. In any case, the kinds of things that we look for in this class are the moral ecology of everyday life, since everything that we do has some qualities of good or evil in it, and we try to sort of pay attention to what's structured into the things that we do. We try to look at ecology, which is a word that comes from the Greek meaning household, and is a science of relationships. So we're always interested in how things relate to one another. One of my favorite words is connections. What are the connections between this and that? And we try to look at everyday life because that's what they're living and that's what they're going to be living the rest of their lives. And so it's useful for them to think about the kinds of things that are going on in their lives. So this is something that we might do for about a week in this class, and it's sort of a synthesis of things that have gone on in that class on cars. And I've told people before, I'm by profession a historian. I'm probably the only historian with no memory at all. I need to read the text that I brought with me, otherwise I get very confused. So I'm going to read a text for you that I hope we can talk about. You don't have to wait until I'm done reading in order to talk. In fact, it would probably give my voice some relief if in the middle somebody said, "Hey, what do you mean by that?" Or, "God, that was a dumb idea," or something like that. So anyway, I will start, and you'll have to figure out when the time is to ask that question or make that statement. Jesus was a citizen of an underdeveloped country, and so he didn't have a car. But I am a citizen of an overdeveloped country, and so I have two of them, a Ford Taurus station wagon and a Honda Civic. Americans have twice as many cars per capita as the people of Western Europe, and 250 times as many per capita as the people of India. 41% of the world's cars are owned by the 6% of the world's people who are Americans, and we buy 9 million new cars every year. Cars account for 10% of the American gross national product. 15 million Americans, 22% of the workforce, work making and servicing cars. And we spend 15% of our income and an inordinate amount of time on automotive transport. We are what James Flink calls a car culture. And Flink uses another term that I like to use a lot in classes. He says that we are a culture of automobility. And I think that's true. And if as a historian, I would say probably the automobile is the most important fact of 20th century American life. The Depression, World War II, the World Wars, they were important, but they're nowhere near as important in terms of the ways that everyday Americans are affected as cars. Just over 100 years ago, believe it or not, there were no cars in the United States. As far as historians can tell, people lived fully human lives without automobiles. They walked, or they used the power of animals to transport themselves. For long distances, they rode railroads. In cities, they rode trolleys. Now, in America, a life without cars is almost unthinkable. They have become an essential part of the habits of our hearts. The car is an essential element of contemporary American culture. The word automobile combines two classic American values, auto or individualism, and mobile or mobility. The car is the machine for the mobility of the self, a technology that embodies American values of individualism, freedom, mobility, comfort, and convenience. And that's why they're so popular. They fit with our value system very well. Cars, claims Richard North, the author of a book that I've mentioned in here several times, a book called The Real Cost, in which there are separate chapters on things like hamburgers and jeans and water and Coke, giving the real cost of those things rather than just the price of them. Cars represent private versus public morality. They are a technology which in America has been synonymous with progress. We tend to think that technologies are progress. And in fact, in the 1950s and 60s, General Electric used to advertise that progress is our most important product. And that meant that if you had bought a toaster from General Electric, you had bought progress. With their annual model changes, cars have more than any other technology in the United States incorporated American dreams of planned obsolescence and inevitable progress. You don't do that with toasters. You don't trade in the 1983 toaster for the new 1985 toaster or things like that. But you can do that with cars. The new 1996 Ford is a small part of what Clement Greenberg called the tradition of the new, which I find a really interesting phrase because it's a kind of paradox involved in there, the tradition of the new that Americans conserve so efficiently. But a technology, as Langdon Winter points out in a beautiful book called The Whale and the Reactor, is a complex reality, part of what Robert Bellick calls the problem of invisible complexity. The things we call technologies, Winter says, are ways of building order in the world. The issues that divide or unite people in society are settled not only in the institutions and practices of politics proper, but also, and less obviously, in tangible arrangements of steel and concrete, wires and semiconductors, nuts and bolts. Cars make many things possible and many other things impossible or improbable. They are as political as the Democrats and the Republicans, and more effective than either the Democrats or the Republicans, because we don't suspect them of everything, of anything. We assume that they're not political, but in fact there's a politics of cars, and it's simply built into our lives in such a way that most of the time we never see it. As I said earlier, I do American studies, and that's interdisciplinary. And a car is a perfect example of an interdisciplinary topic. A car is a wheeled vehicle powered usually by an internal combustion engine. Driving a car is an interdisciplinary event which requires a biological being to sit in a technological artifact manufactured and distributed in a market economy and by various kind of motor movements to produce a chemical reaction to make mechanical power in social spaces that are constructed and regulated by political entities. So you can see that we're into about 6 or 7 different disciplines anytime we go out driving in a car. Cars have affected cultural geography, domestic architecture, foreign policy, and social psychology in this country. As Andrew Wernick says, cars transform the whole ecology of life, both at the individual level, affecting private and occupational mobility, indeed our whole sense of time and space. And in fact, it's very interesting that we often transform miles into time and vice versa. And the time that we have in mind when we say, you know, how far is it from Seattle to X? We say 15 minutes. The time that we have in mind is car time. I mean, we never assume that anybody would walk from Seattle to X. Car time has become the sort of conventional kind of time that we can talk about. It also translates the ecology of life socially, creating massive dependent industries, road systems, and transformed cities. Now, I'm going to eventually in this talk go out for a drive in my car, but first of all, we need to get the infrastructure in place to do that. And let's start with oil. Internal combustion engines require oil, a non-renewable energy resource which is fast being depleted. Oil was discovered in the United States in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania. There were some really big discoveries around the turn of the century, just about the time that automobiles were being invented. And so this coincidence of big oil discoveries and cars was a really useful kind of thing. Interestingly enough, early on, the gasoline was a... They used oil for a variety of different things, largely for illumination, and the gasoline was a byproduct that they would just waste. It wasn't useful to them at all. So the cars actually did something for a part of the refinement of oil that had been, until that time, been wasted. Since 1976, Americans have used more petroleum for transportation than we have produced, and so we're now a net importer of petroleum. And cars account for a greater share of oil demand than they did at the time of the first oil crisis. And this is, I think when I wrote that, it was a couple of years ago. Even more so now, as Americans buy more and more pickup trucks and sport utility vehicles, which are not very good for gas efficiency. The production and distribution of gasoline involves energy and environmental costs of its own. You have to do something to get gasoline from one place to another. It doesn't just move that way by magic. Oil wells and oil rigs take energy to construct and maintain, and they routinely leak oil into the environment. The transportation of oil by pipeline and tanker also involves energy expenditures and accidents. The United States is, in fact, the number one nation in the world for major oil spills affecting our shores. The Exxon Valdez accident of about a decade ago was just one of many normal accidents. This is an important term to keep in mind, normal accidents. It was clearly an accident, but when you're transporting oil at this rate we do, those accidents are normal. They're going to happen. We have normal accidents in this country, and these normal accidents are planned by our use of gasoline-powered cars. Those are 35% of world cars in use. They drive 1.25 trillion miles annually, as much as all other world cars together. People in America's cities use twice as much gas per capita as people in Australia's cities, 4 times as much as European urbanites, and 10 times as much as Asian city drivers. Even rising prices of oil, although you have to keep in mind that real prices of oil have been absolutely flat since the 1950s, the prices on the gas pump go up, but in terms of real cost, the cost of oil is about the same now as it was in 1957 or something like that. When I started driving, it was about 29 cents a gallon. Sometimes you'd have gas wars that would get it down to 21 cents a gallon. But even at now a dollar more than that, it's still about the same price in terms of real dollars. Even rising prices of oil do not reflect its real cost to society. They don't take account of the finite character of oil reserves or of the environmental burdens of a gas-powered country, nor do they give an honest account of the other resources depleted in cars, steel, glass, rubber, all of which consume energy in production as well. We often think that cars consume energy mainly when we're driving them, but it's important to remember how much energy is consumed in creating them as well, and then the creating other parts of the infrastructure that are important for cars. Okay, now we turn from the powering of the cars to the sort of the infrastructure that's necessary for the cars to go. Now, cars require service stations, for example, oases of gasoline and of repairs that keep Americans on the road. Cars require parking places. Parking a car at home, the office, and the shopping mall requires an average 4,000 square feet of asphalt per car. At home, we park cars in the garage, a structure which in my neighborhood is larger and more commodious than most third world housing. I live in a culture that provides houses for cars, but not for homeless people. And this is a kind of an oddity. In the suburb where I live, almost all of the houses have two-car garages, and the newer ones almost all have three-car garages. And the garages actually are becoming the most important part of the facade of the house. You go down some streets and you begin to think that cars live there and some, you know, people with them. But it looks really from the front of the house, because you have to have such a wide garage in order to get three cars in there, that it's mainly for cars. The garage is an interesting cultural invention itself. Because it replaced a barn for horses, it originally was located at some distance from the middle-class home because you didn't want the horses right around. Then it moved closer, but it was still a freestanding structure. My mother still has a freestanding garage, although it tilts sort of like this, so it's not as freestanding as it once was. Now that the garage has moved into the house and in many cases dominates the architectural facade of the house, the reason for this movement of the garage may simply be convenience. I must say, in Minnesota, it's convenient to be able to have a garage that's attached to the house in the wintertime. But the authors of a book called Driving Passion think that it may also symbolize Americans' acceptance of cars into the family. And we talk about family cars, and in many ways the car does become a part of the family. People kind of treat it and talk to it in ways that you might a family member. Two-thirds of all new houses in the United States have two-car garages, so domestic architecture tells us that the car is an essential part of what it means to be an American. Cars also function in American culture as symbols, as they have at least since the 1920s. In that decade, researchers in Muncie, Indiana, discovered that many families owned cars but lacked indoor plumbing, and they asked one person why. "Well," she said, "you can't go to town in a bathtub." Seems just exactly right to me. More recently, French philosopher Roland Barthes has observed that cars today are almost the exact equivalent of the great Gothic cathedrals, the supreme creation of an era, conceived with passion by unknown artists and consumed in image, if not in usage, by the whole population, which appropriates them as purely magical objects. My son, who's 13, is a subscriber to Car and Driver magazine, and there's a kind of fetishism of cars in Car and Driver that would support that statement fully. Culturally, cars have been symbols of progress and modernity, and each year's annual model makes earlier models obsolescent as a progressive symbol. Parked at home, like furniture, like the domicile itself, cars project a sense of the owner's relative social standing. It makes a difference what cars are on your driveway. Too, as markers of identity within an anonymously circulating public, they readily become subject to the fashion dynamics of competitive display, which manufacturers have naturally encouraged to accelerate obsolescence and sales. In the Twin Cities, that class and cultural status is reflected even in car ownership. 35% of Black and Indian households in the Twin Cities and 18% of Hispanic and Asian households do without automobiles, but only 8% of white households are carless. There is a continuum of symbolism in cars, too, as different cars mean different things. The sports car, for example, generally implies in the culture freedom, power, usually masculine power, although there's now more attention being paid to female drivers of sports cars. Speed, single status, or at least a status of married without children. The family car, like my Ford Taurus station wagon, on the other hand, serves the nuclear family and preserves it as a cultural icon. The two rows of seat in the sedan separate parents from children and represent the family hierarchy, since parents usually ride in front and children in back. Although in our family, we were never able to convince the kids that that was possible or probable. And now my son has one of these tape or CD things that has to plug into the cigarette lighter. So he claims that he always has to ride shotgun because it's absolutely necessary. The fact that the father usually drives also represents different gender roles in the family. And there are some families where it can be really kind of touchy if the woman decides that she wants to drive. Cars also fit into the life cycle of Americans and are a kind of, they're one of the most important ways that we symbolize growing up in America. And I would contend that the coming of age at 16 to get your driver's license is the most important rite of passage in American culture. And I suggest that compared to other rites of passages in other cultures, it's one of the most, it's one of the worst rites of passage that a culture could possibly have. A rite of passage is supposed to be something where the young people have been through a kind of training, have been through a kind of period of reflection. They've often been out to the wilderness to reflect on what it means to live in community. They come back and then they go through a rite of passage of one sort or another that signifies that they're adults in the culture. And what we do is we make them take driver's ed and then give them a driver's license and tell them that in some way they're becoming adults in this culture. And what we've told them is, in fact, almost nothing about living in community because the car moves us away from community. It is the automobile, the self, the autonomous self in mobility. So we have that particular rite of passage. In our churches, we have a rite of passage called confirmation. But my sense of in American culture is that probably more people anticipate their 16th birthday and the driver's license than they do confirmation. You don't see a lot of kids sort of breathlessly waiting around until the day they are confirmed. But you do see a lot of kids waiting for the driver's license, and a lot of times now in the suburbs, with the driver's license comes a car of one's own, which is a symbol of the freedom and autonomy that we socialize children to have. This is one of the odd things about American culture, is the socialization process in American culture. We have socialization for autonomy. This is exactly what we train children to do, and we do it from a very, very early age. And I've been complicit in this in my own family. I can remember telling kids all the time, you know, oh, you got dressed by yourself, and sort of with a voice of excitement to encourage them to do that. By yourself is that autonomy there. Of course, I'm not sure that we want people, you know, being dressed by their parents into their 30s and 40s or things like that. Being dressed by themselves is probably a good idea at some point. But I can also remember with pride the first time that my son banged out the screen door in the front to go down to a friend's house on his own, about 3 or 4, and thinking, oh, that's good. But that's because autonomy is the main thing that Americans are socializing their kids for.
I was just going to say, the other thing it's socializing for is for consumption. You know,
right.
Very dramatic.
For consumption, big time, because as we said earlier, 15% of American money gets spent on cars.
One of the points that Carol Gilligan says is that boys are
that's right.
This way. And I don't know whether that's true now of girls as well, but clearly girls still have a different upbringing, being more socialized for family and relationships,
right,
as opposed to autonomy and
independence. Let's ask about that. I have two boys, and so they're both pretty anxious to have cars, and I do have a sense that there's a gender thing in cars still. Can either some of you young women or those of you who have girls in your family talk about, do girls anticipate this in the same way that boys do? Does it have the same sorts of meanings?
Yes. Not necessarily. I waited until I was 22 years old to get a driver's license and got endless heckling from friends and relatives because they couldn't believe that I wasn't independent enough to own a car. I graduated from college before I got a driver's license, but I wasn't independent.
Yeah, it's un-American to not have a driver's license, pretty much, I think. I mean, you know, there was, in the 1950s, they would talk about card-carrying communists. Well, now, if you're not a card-carrying driver's license, I mean, you're a suspect sort of person, I think.
Well, you're supposed to be a grown-up. I think, for me, you know, 18 is about 21 to drink. But 16 is pretty big. I'd say that's bigger than 21 for me, because you get power. You have your own keys. You get a keychain. You walk around school, hang those in your locker, you know. And you have this thing, this expensive thing that, you know, who knows how much it costs, that you're driving around, that, ooh, you're suddenly responsible.
Right, I think that's the case. I always remind my kids just how much that machine costs.
Maybe the girls don't make the sounds that the boys do, anticipating. I mean, boys, even in, I mean, I was 2 years in New Guinea, and boys there made motor sounds all the time. You thought, they don't even have any engines. What's this? But they...
Right. I mean, if you actually you give any young boy anything with wheels, and all of a sudden there are motor sounds around.
I think often for girls, it's a way to get to their friends. You know, it's kind of a socialization thing, just even in and of itself.
Yeah, I think that's also true for boys. My 17-year-old tends to use it mainly for that, to get to friends. But that's part of what's going on there is the transition from being a kind of family-oriented person to being a peer-oriented person, and in a way, in giving the driver's license to kids at 16, we are saying we think it's a good idea for you to become more peer-oriented than family-oriented, and that we're willing to. I mean, it's our way of saying we're willing to let go to some extent.
I hear lots of moms. I had all sons, so I don't relate to the girl thing, but lots of moms say it gives moms. Moms don't have to take their kids here and there.
To chauffeur, right.
Take themselves or other siblings to different, like, dance lessons, baseball practice.
Well, in the suburbs, which I described the other day, the suburbs are what David Orr would call a social trap. They're a thing that's been structured in such a way that you make individually rational decisions, like driving your car to soccer and dance and music lessons and the grocery store and to pick up a gallon of milk and to school and all of these different things that you do. They're individually rational decisions that are very hard to get out of on an individual basis, but they're a trap because everybody has to do these things. You all have to drive places, and they're causing ecological consequences, which are really disastrous. In the long run. And there are ways to avoid that, too, because, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, essentially what you want a car for is to get from one place to another. If you could put the places closer together, you wouldn't need the cars. And, in fact, that's the way that societies functioned in the 19th century. The places were closer together, and so people could walk. But the suburbs are actually zoned so that the places have to be far apart, which is... it may have been attractive at one point for some reasons, but right now it doesn't make much sense. And yet the dominant form of suburban development still is to create spaces.
Well, I think we're going to have our children who say, Mom, Dad, I want a car, I need to go. And 10 years from now, 15 years from now, they're going to say, why? Because we don't have the petroleum. Why not? They're going to be madder than heck at us as a civilization helping push that on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's true about cars, I think, about car culture anyway, is that it's going to be a very short-lived thing in the history of the world. It's going to be 150 years or something like that. We've had them for 100 years now. The oil might last another 50 years. There actually are some technological things going on that may allow us to have the kind of mobility that we have now without the ecological consequences. I don't think all of the problems can be solved with technological solutions, though, or technological fixes. It will require social and political conversations and decisions in order to solve the problems. Well, anyway, let's go back to, we now have the infrastructure in place, so now I can go driving. With the cultural and symbolic infrastructure now in place, I am ready to get in the car and get ready to go. Once I am in my car, in my garage, I take up almost 100 times the space I do on foot. And I am in a different relation to the world and my neighbors. A person in a car experiences the landscape differently than a person on foot. A person on foot has time for details, but a person in a car is restricted only to general features of the landscape. You might imagine what will happen when Holden puts in a road, say, from here to Heart Lake. what the experience will be of going by at 55 miles an hour up to Heart Lake and then turning around and coming back at 55. It will be a slightly different experience than what we now have as we go up to Heart Lake. Most cars, too, keep us from the weather, which doesn't always happen when you go to Heart Lake. I got rained on the last mile back when I went to Heart Lake on Tuesday. But cars with wipers and heaters and air conditioners are enclosed environments that keep us from the surrounding environment. The car is rapidly becoming a home away from home with its own stereo and telephone. And now a lot of my son's friends have televisions in their vans. And I presume people have faxes. And I'm looking forward to seeing cars with kitchens, which I suspect is coming soon.
Vans.
Yeah, I guess vans do have kitchens. So I suspect you can really do just about.
You can't do it when you're driving, though. No. You have to stop to do it.
Oh, I know.
That's all microwave. No, that's microwave.
Yeah, there'll be microwave things
in there. You're driving back to somebody with a cellular phone.
Well,
it's dangerous.
You and I are going to be driven crazy very quickly because I think it's not going to be long before a majority of people are going to be driving one hand with cellular phones.
They make it illegal.
Stop and talk.
Yeah, well, come on. Stop and talk? What a radical idea. I've asked the bookstore to pick up two books for the series of things that I'm doing here, and I want to read a little bit from each of them today to give you a flavor of what they're like. This is the one by Alan Durning called How Much is Enough? The Consumer Society and the Future of the Earth. It's put out by the World Watch Institute, and I just want to read a paragraph or so here. For the consumer class, us, longer commutes, greater sprawl, and worsening congestion all translate into lots of time in the car. Working Americans now spend 9 hours a week behind the wheel. I did the calculations on this. This is about, what did I say the other day? I can't remember. 2.5 weeks or 3.5 weeks of your year are taken up in the car. To make these homes away from home more comfortable, car manufacturers and drivers pile on the options. Some 92% of new U.S. cars have air conditioning, up from 5% in 1960. Air conditioning increases by two-thirds a car's contribution to climate change and adds ozone-depleting chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere, although new air conditioners won't have the chlorofluorocarbons. Compact disc players will likely be in most new cars by the end of the 90s, and microwave ovens and telephones may not be far behind. The logical conclusion of this trend is already evident in a phenomenon automotive analysts dub carcooning, in which drivers turn their four-wheelers into electronic cocoons outfitted with coffee makers, fax machines, televisions, and other gadgetry of the modern home. In my car, I also encounter my neighbors differently. Cars have the overall effect of spreading people out and keeping them apart. Rather than meeting people as we go about our business to and from stores and school and work, generally we see each other in well-defined indoor spaces. The more traffic there is in an area, the less likely are residents to know their neighbors and to think of it as home territory. And I think it's something like 72% of Americans don't know their next-door neighbors. When I pass my neighbors in my car, I am limited mainly to an expression of simple recognition, a hand gesture that goes something like this. And that's the extent of communication between us as we're in our cars. Okay, now with that, I'm still in the garage now, sort of. I think I've got the car on, but I haven't gone anywhere yet. With that in mind, or more usually out of mind, I back my car out of the garage. If I am an average American driver, the car is virtually empty. 87% of American car trips have at most two passengers. In fact, although car mileage decreased in the 1970s, the amount of energy used per passenger mile of car travel was as high in 1984 as in 1971 because people were traveling alone more often. In the Twin Cities between 1970 and 1990, the number of trips per day rose by 3 million a day, or 74%, even though the population rose only 19%. Only 2.5% of these trips are by bus, the rest are by automobiles. The average household makes 10 car trips a day compared with 8 in 1970. But people in wealthier households average 14 trips a day, probably because they have more cars. Household travel diaries showed that Twin Cities residents travel on average an hour a day in the environmental cocoon of a car. The amazing increase in 20 years, most of which followed the oil crisis of 1973, was caused by more cars, more people working, and more suburbanites. Still, due to more highways and more highway metering in the Twin Cities, the average commute time increased only a minute from 20 to 21 minutes in 1990. The Minnesota Department of Transportation notes that in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area, 96% of the traffic comes from cars like mine and from pickup trucks, motorcycles, etc. The other 4% is commercial vehicles. 18% of the car trips in the metro area are from home to work. 53% are from home to some other activity like shopping, which we'll talk about next Friday. Only 29% of trips involve trips whose origin or destination is not home, trips from work to shopping or from shopping to shopping, etc. So if we restructured things so that their homes were closer to the things that we want to go to, we could cut down on the amount of car use that we have. Anyway, quickly, I get out on the road and into congestion. My car gives me unlimited mobility and freedom just as long as everybody else doesn't exercise their mobility and freedom at the same time. But more cars on the road have led to more congestion, which can almost bring traffic to a standstill. In Southern California, even with all of the freeways and with all of the lanes on the freeways, average car speeds are estimated at only 33 miles an hour. That's throughout the day, with predictions of a drop to 15 miles an hour by the year 2000. Congestion means that I am using gasoline for going nowhere fast, or sometimes for going nowhere at all. The U.S. Department of Transportation estimates that Americans waste 3 billion gallons of gasoline. Wasted 3 billion gallons of gasoline in 1984 due to traffic congestion, and they project that we will waste 7 billion gallons of gasoline by the year 2000. As I drive, cruising along, now that I've gotten out of the congestion, I've gone across 494 in the southern part of the metro area, and I've turned south on 35W to head towards St. Olaf College. I am polluting the air. As Alan Derning says in How Much is Enough, the simple act of starting a car imperceptibly changes the global climate. For each gallon of gas I use, I put 20 pounds of pollution into the air. Gasoline is about 85% carbon, and as the gas burns in my engine, the carbon is released into the air, where it combines with oxygen to become carbon dioxide, which weighs 4 times as much as the original carbon. If I get 20 miles per gallon of gas in my car, which is what gets advertised when you see car ads, I only get 1 mile per pound of pollution. That's something that doesn't get advertised. In the car ads. That would be kind of interesting to see in the car ads. You know, the 1996 Ford Taurus gets 20 miles a gallon and 1 mile per pound of pollution. That would be what David Orr would want when he talks about wanting to have an honest accounting. He simply wants people to know what are the costs of things rather than the price. My car and others like it are responsible for about 1/3 of fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions in the United States. On a single trip to work, therefore, I contribute 40 pounds of pollution to the greenhouse effect. It will take 200 trees to absorb the carbon dioxide emitted by the average American car this year. This means that my work, since I drive to work, had better have some lasting benefit. Otherwise, students are buying education at the cost of the biosphere. But my car is not through polluting. In addition to the carbon dioxide emissions, it pollutes the air with nitrogen oxide, carbon monoxide, lead, sulfur dioxide, and particulate matter. I can be thankful, however, that I am not driving a diesel truck because it emits 8 times more pollution than an equivalent vehicle run on gas. So cars pollute the air, but they also pollute our ears. People in cars often find highway noise so irritating that they close the windows and turn on the air conditioner, thus affecting the ozone layer. People who live in homes near the highways experience so much noise that they too keep their windows closed, losing the benefits of ventilation and fresh air. Cars also pollute the landscape as hulks, as wrecks. My first car resides in the A1 Auto Graveyard in Champaign, Illinois. But I don't know actually where the rest of my cars are buried. There's a wonderful New Yorker article on automobile tires and the mountains of automobile tires that are created in some places and the real problems that happen when they catch on fire because they're almost impossible to stop after that. It was a John McPhee article on automobile tires. So they're out there somewhere too, the tires that I've used over time. Cars also cause immediate health problems for the flesh and bones of biological beings which are not designed for impacts up to 60 miles an hour. That would be us. In the United States, cars kill over 40,000 people a year, and they injure even more. If this were a war or a terrorist incident, it would be a crisis or a scandal. but it is only the normal accidents that are part of the design of the car. The health-related costs of cars are also immense, but we tend to see them, as I said the other day, as side effects. The effects of cars are getting where we want to go. Everything else is just side effects. And I try to think, as I was reading this over today, I was trying to think, if I proposed to you creating a transportation system in the United States that would kill 40,000 people a year, if we had to debate this before we put it into practice, I suspect that there'd be some opposition to that, to killing 40,000 people a year. But again, most of the time we don't think about that at all. This is, again, the invisible complexity of American culture. Now, when I drive my car, I am involved in a physical activity that includes sitting, hand-eye coordination, minor wrist movements, and a few coordinated footsteps. When I am driving, I am not involved in any other form of physical activity, except for the sort of normal ones like breathing. And so my muscular development is not enhanced by driving. Cars have indirect as well as direct health effects. And then, of course, I need to join a gym so that I can get on a Stairmaster and walk in ways that I might have done if I had walked from wherever it was I was to somewhere else. Given all these social costs of my cars, it might be sensible for me to sell them. But I live in a metropolitan area that has been shaped by cars and which now virtually requires cars. Studies show that roughly 80% of American driving is for, quote, necessities, like commuting and shopping and going to get gas for the car. After World War II, almost all new housing built in metropolitan areas was located in the suburbs. From 1960 to 1980, two-thirds of all jobs created have been located in the suburbs. And this is an important thing to remember, because often we think of the suburbs as being entirely residential. But in fact, they are occupational spaces as well. And they're an important part of the problems of the inner cities, where we've concentrated the unemployed people. And we've not provided them ways to get to where the new jobs are. The new jobs are in the suburb. Without mass transit, they have no way to get there. And so we've isolated them geographically from the work that we think that they should have. And so we have these big political debates about how poor people ought to work. But we've structured the environment so that it's very difficult for them to do that. Anyway, with all these jobs created located in the suburbs, as a result, the number of commutes within central city areas has remained fairly stable, while the number of trips between central cities and suburbs and from suburb to suburb has doubled in the same time. And this is one of the problems with mass transit in a place like the Twin Cities area, is mass transit used to work pretty well when people in the suburbs were all going downtown to work. But now that the jobs are in different suburbs, it's hard to lay out mass transit lines in such a way that you can get people where they in fact want to go. We've now decentralized the jobs enough that it's real hard to do mass transit. As Michael Renner suggests, the automobile has actually created more distance than it overcomes. Mass transit is available in my neighborhood. There are two buses a day, and they go downtown. So, and that's it. So it's not a real attractive proposition. There are very few people in the neighborhood who can make any use of it at all. My cars are problematic by themselves and with all of these effects that I've told you about so far, but they also run on 3 million miles of paved roads in the United States, roads which are not anymore fields or forests or farmland. The United States has paved in this century 60,000 square miles of its territory, which is about 2% of total surface area and 10% of all arable land in the country. Nationwide, as Alan Durning points out, pavement covers an area larger than the state of Georgia. There are days when I watch Newt Gingrich when I can imagine paving over Georgia would be a good idea, but we haven't done that. We've just paved over an area the size of the state of Georgia. In most American cities, almost half of the urban space goes to accommodate the automobile. In Los Angeles, it is two-thirds of urban space is for the automobiles. So again, if you had somebody coming down from another planet to look at us and looking at Los Angeles, they would have to almost decide that cars are the real beings here, and they have these little kind of organic things that inhabit them for various times during the day. In the United States, are considered a form of social, economic, energy, and ecological engineering. And here I'm talking about politics and policy, because politics is also involved in cars. Early on, the gas tax was passed to provide money for roads. This was, I think, in 1917 or 1918. From that time on, American governments at all levels have used public money to subsidize the private motor car. During the 1930s, the government took note of the efficiencies of Germany's Autobahn system, but not, interestingly enough, of the efficiencies of its Volkswagen, which was invented at the same time. And they mapped an interstate system as early as 1939. But World War II intervened and post-war conversion delayed construction. But car traffic doubled between 1940 and 1954. So in 1956, the federal government passed the Interstate Highway Act, pledging a 90% federal share for the construction of an integrated system of 41,000 miles of freeway. This is they got it passed because they connected it up to defense stuff. It was the National Defense Highway Act of 1956, and the theory of it was that it would be useful for evacuating cities in case of a nuclear war. Although they get congested enough just, you know, for rush hour, and it would really be rush hour if there were a nuclear war, I suspect. So I don't think they probably would have worked in exactly that way, but that was one way you could sell it to the American public in the 1950s. The American interstate highway system is the largest civil engineering structure in the world. It dwarfs by hundreds of times the pyramids in Egypt and things like that. So again, it's a substantial amount of thing. These roads connect a great many places in the country, but they also divide places. Limited access highways, especially the interstates, have killed rural towns and divided urban communities. In Minneapolis, Interstate 35W runs north into the city, and then it makes a sharp swerve at the Crosstown Highway and then goes north again for a little while. And I always wondered why that was, and so then I started to think about it. As far as I can see, there are two reasons for it. The first plans for the freeway showed it going straight up, right along Lindale Avenue. But that complicated the tangle of traffic on Lindale and Hennepin. But still, I don't think that was the most important reason. The most important reason was that if it went straight up, it would have run through an upper middle class neighborhood called Tangletown. And that was too politically controversial to do. And so I think it turns there, and then they ran it up right through a poor people's neighborhood, which is often what happens with highways in American cities. Histories of Robert Moses' work in New York City, he was the sort of major road maker there, show that the displacement of poor people was often a consequence of good roads. And in Minneapolis, there were vital neighborhoods that were split by the interstate highways, and that just simply meant too much time to walk around to where the bridges are in order to maintain those community things. And communities tend to fall apart as a result of that along the freeway.
An interesting thing that I heard just a couple weeks ago was that in Los Angeles, where the bridges had fallen during an earthquake, the community petitioned the government to have that bridge put somewhere else. They rerouted the highway out of that neighborhood, and they're making that land now. They're trying to decide what they're going to do. But it's uniting two different neighborhoods. There's this big space now.
Right. I mean, again, you think of highways as things for cars to go somewhere, but they also have these other ecological effects, social ecological effects, because they divide people. People, especially on busy roads, you can't do the pedestrian thing that you might do otherwise. America's love affair with the automobile also has an international impact, with detrimental effects on many third world cultures as they try to imitate American styles of consumption, including American styles of automobility. So American automobility is an integral part of the moral ecology of everyday life. Cars are not likely to disappear anytime soon, but it may be that we can improve their environmental impact. Some of the solutions will be technical. They will involve lighter cars made of composite materials with alternate fuels, cars powered by natural gas or the sun or hydrogen. Mercedes-Benz is working on a car that runs on hydrogen. Which would be kind of nice, since hydrogen is the most that there is in the world, or hybrid cars, which I just read about in a issue of E Magazine, which is out here in the magazine reading area here. But technical solutions will not be enough. The very success of mass motorization, claims Michael Renner, has created conditions that cannot be ameliorated simply by making cars more efficient and less polluting. Some solutions may be regulatory, trying to give an honest accounting of the cost of cars. The Environmental Protection Agency has been toying with the idea of tolling the urban interstate highway systems, so that you would have to pay by the mile that you drove on those interstate highway systems. And that would make people aware of what is the honest cost of driving a certain amount of distance. In Minneapolis now, and in most cities, I think there are now carpool lanes, which are another way of trying to make people aware of the honest cost of what they're doing. Another option that we could undertake if we wanted to would be energy taxes, to tax people on their use of fossil fuel energy. As you may have noticed in the last year, as the Republicans talked about repealing the three cent raise in the gas tax, this is a solution that's going nowhere fast. People are not about to vote for a large increase in the gas tax, although I think it would be one of the most rational things that this country could do. We may decide to subsidize other forms of transportation as much as we have subsidized cars in the last century, and that would be a heck of a lot because the government has spent a tremendous amount of money on cars. And we might subsidize, for example, bicycles or light rail. We also may look for geographic solutions, as I suggested earlier. We use cars to get to places we want to go, and we could use them less if we could rearrange the spaces of our lives. Dolores Hayden's book, Redesigning the American Dream, is a really good book on sort of zoning and the ways that zoning might be simply redone to create different kinds of spaces. And as I mentioned in the talk that I did the other day, when I think I got off the subject, was really more along the lines of this subject, people like pedestrian spaces. Holden Village works really well, and you get to know people here because it's a pedestrian village. And Holden also works because the coffee is out there at 10 o'clock, and coffee is an important part of social spaces. But, you know, when you're walking here, you see people and you recognize them, and you were at a session I was in yesterday. What did you think of that? And those kinds of conversations can happen. Imagine if all of us were in little motor cars, just sort of going up and down to the chalets or the lodges or something like that. You cut off all the possibilities of that conversation. And so there are lots of designers now who are trying to imagine what they call urban villages, spaces that would get back to some things that were possible in the late 19th century, keeping things integrated so that you don't have these carefully zoned and segregated spaces that we now have in the suburbs. But other solutions will involve changes in character and purpose. We may at some point in our history or our car history decide that the freedom of the self to move, the automobility enshrined in American culture, is not the primary value in our lives. And we may want to choose technologies that fulfill us not as autonomous individuals, not as automobile selves, but as selves in relation to others. We may want to choose what Ivan Illich calls tools for conviviality, to provide institutional and infrastructural support for the social relations that have eroded in the American century of cars. That's a phrase I really like a lot, tools for conviviality, tools that bring us together. And you can think of all kinds of tools that are tools for conviviality. For the younger set around Holden Village here, a deck of cards is a tool for conviviality. It brings people together. They all know a certain game. By the end of the week, they are crying when each other are sort of going out of the village. All kinds of board games are tools for conviviality. Just the structure up here, the arc, is a tool for conviviality because it puts seats at angles to each other that make conversations easy. The round tables in the dining hall, the fact that the dining tables are only 8 in size, are tools for conviviality. And you can imagine all kinds of ones that could do that. Usually, though, when we do technologies, we're only interested in solving a particular problem, and we're not thinking about what are the social consequences of the use of this particular tool. So we might do more of that. And I want to end with reading just a little bit here from Bill McKibben's book. This is The Age of Missing Information. As I've mentioned some other times, this is a book where he watched all 105 channels of the Lynchburg, Virginia cable system for 24 hours and then took a walk on a mountain. He really did this and still had a brain afterwards, which just amazes me. He didn't watch the reruns twice. I mean, you know, a lot of times you might find Leave It to Beaver on 4 or 5 times on a 105 channel cable system, so he didn't watch all of them. Anyway, here's just a paragraph from McKibben. We've now, as a species, lived through extremes. We know that people will flee from backbreaking labor at the first chance, but we might be starting to sense that the total abandonment of skillful and careful labor, the utter emancipation offered by light bulbs and machines, can be just as alienating, quite aside from their environmental dangers. And perhaps we're starting to sense something deeply human in a life less engaged with the world of consumption and growth and comfort offered by television, and more engaged with the world of balance and pleasure and elegant simplicity suggested by the natural world. You don't need to live in the country to understand these kinds of changes. City dwellers and suburbanites can continue to drive everywhere, hoping that the ever-progressing society will deliver hydrogen cars or solar cars or whatever kind, other kinds of cars soon enough to save the atmosphere. Or they can begin to use existing technology, the bicycle, for instance. It's every bit as technological as an electric car, and as a significant minority of people have discovered, it's endlessly more elegant. On a bicycle, you see the world around you. You notice hills that a car obliterates. You see neighborhoods at a pace that makes them real, not a blur. You save gas, of course, but you also hear your body again. TV can't appreciate that kind of elegance. On TV, you'd buy an Infiniti and drive it quickly to Jack LaLanne, where you can pay someone to let you sit on a stationary bicycle and pump away. I'll stop there. You have lots and lots of experience, I trust, as drivers in this culture, and probably can teach me some things that I don't know about cars.
One thing you didn't mention, and I don't drive to work. I bus and I bike, and occasionally I walk. It's 3 miles to work. And the time I take to bike is... I have a very stressful job, so the time in which I take getting there and returning is great thought time and
transition time.
Where if I drove, it's 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I mean, just from a human standpoint, family standpoint, it's just great.
Yeah.
It just really helps me, I think, being far better family member, let alone society.
Yeah. Unfortunately, cars can have that same effect. I have a fairly long commute, and so I have that same benefit of just a time to sort of come down from the teaching that I do,
mm-hmm.
to begin to think in my mind, okay, what's for dinner tonight, and do I have the stuff that I need in order to cook that dinner tonight? And so by the time I get close to home, I can stop by the grocery store on the way home if I need to. So that can happen also in cars. It's not exclusive to bicycles. But it can be an important sort of thing. The thing about bicycles that McKibben would emphasize is that you know the hills because your muscles know the hills, and that's something that you don't know in a car. The amount of
odoriferous.
Pardon me?
Maybe a little odoriferous, but
yeah, right. Well, odoriferous would be another subject that I'd love to. In fact, I'm working on a. I think I told you that I am on radio now in Minnesota, Dr. Culture, and Dr. Culture gets to analyze all sorts of things. And deodorants is one that I really want to spend some time on. I heard when Garrison Keillor was doing the Prairie Home Companion, he used to do it as a morning show and not just the once a week thing. And he used to have all kinds of advertisers for it. And one of the advertisers that he had for the early morning program was Irish Rose Odorant Jelly. And the question, the sales slogan for this odorant jelly, which would make you smell, was why smell like a rose when you can smell like high heaven, which I thought was just great. And it's just simply a matter of cultural things. You know, we could learn to appreciate sweat smells if we wanted to, but at this point it would be less profitable, I think, to manufacturers to just let us sweat than it is for them to sell us these things that seal off the pores that we have and mess around with our smells. In Norman Mailer's book, Of a Fire on the Moon, which is a wonderful cultural account of the moonshot of the late 1960s, he has several long digressions on how impoverished the American sense of smell is and how deodorants are a part of that impoverishment that Americans don't want to smell each other.
I was thinking when you were going through all this, the details of what it takes to run a car, that when I was in high school, which was in the 50s, I had a teacher that read, once a week would read us something from, I think it was Popular Science, a magazine. And so this must have been about the year 1954, say, that somebody had invented a car that ran on a borax-based fuel. Very simple engine, and it was, you know, it's a flutter of excitement about that, and people talked about it, and then it just disappeared. And
why?
It was, well, I mean, I'm sure that the car, I'm sure that the gasoline industry bought it out or killed the guy or whatever.
I've never been able to find any good evidence that the car manufacturers have conspired in that way.
Yeah. But
except for one. General Motors did buy up bus systems, they bought up urban trolley systems. They had a division of General Motors that was designed to buy up trolley systems in America's cities and get rid of the trolleys and actually tear up the tracks so that they could not be reinstituted in the cities because they were going to sell General Motors buses to right. these people.
I lived in L.A. during World War II. We had a wonderful transportation system.
Yeah, the red line.
Yeah.
And that's they destroyed it.
Right. I mean, and trolleys were an elegant form of transportation early in the century. I commute from the Twin Cities to Northfield, which is about 35 miles. Now there's no train service at all between the Twin Cities and Northfield, except maybe freight service goes through there somehow. But in the early 19-teens, there were trolleys that ran all the way from the Twin Cities to Northfield, and then on from there to Mankato, which is another, I don't know, 30, 40 miles. And they made eight round trips a day to Northfield on this trolley, and it was just a single car that was electrically powered. And I've seen pictures of the interior of the car. It was like a middle class parlor. It had big stuffed chairs, lamps next to the chairs. I mean, I would just love to be sitting there reading my New York Times or something like that as I was going to school. But, you know, I'm at a point now where I more or less have to pay attention because I'm driving a car, which is really unfortunate. I don't want to really pay attention to this to driving a car. I'd much rather be doing other things. And I'm in some ways, at some times, endangering other people because I'm trying not to pay attention to the car. And I'm thinking, okay, I've got to do this lecture this morning, and what do I need to know for that? And so I have this little pad of paper that I put on the seat next to me, and I start writing on it. And then, fortunately, on the road that I drive on, they have those strips on the side of the road that go when you're running off the road. So I haven't yet run all the way off the road into the ditch, but this could happen to me sometime.
Had a couple of comments when you were talking about being in touch with your neighbors by waving.
Right.
In West Virginia and a lot of the South, the people don't wave, they drive along like this.
It's just one figure. Yeah. This is, I mean, in a way, this, what this is our version of human communication. You know? we have.
You're talking about the. Difficulty of people finding work because all of the factories, et cetera, being built in the suburbs. I had occasion to catch a plane very early in the morning in Atlanta, and this was when they were getting MARTA going, but it had been established for a while. And first of all, I got on the bus, and it was probably about 6 in the morning. I was the only white person on the bus, and the bus was full. And the same with MARTA. I got on the MARTA. There were very few people on it, and almost all were black. So it seemed at that point, I don't know what it's like there now, that you just were riotous suddenly with other people in your car.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, that's why mass transit is so little supported here, because we have...
It's great.
Right.
All kinds of people are there.
Right. I've been on MARTA in Atlanta too, but going to the northwest suburbs where my sister lives, and in that direction, it's a more racially mixed kind of thing. It tends to be black early on, and then everybody left on the cars is white by the time you get out into the suburbs.
And is it being well used now? That was about 10 years ago.
It was very well used.
One of the things they did right in Los Angeles, I thought, was that they had such a terrible time getting back. After they gave up the streetcars, getting back into the business of public transportation, and after fighting about it for years and years and on, they finally decided that the first link of the mass transit would be through an area where most of the people did not own cars, rather than try. I mean, that was a brilliant move, and then I think it went to Long Beach first. Somebody else was from Los Angeles. I think it went to Long Beach first, and I know I remember one of the things that happened was that they gave free ride to anybody that wanted to go.
Yeah.
So I ended up going down there just to see what it was like. You know, I had to stand the whole way because there were so many people from the suburbs that wanted to try this.
Right. What a novel idea, yeah, mass transit.
But I mean, people really did switch readily from the buses and from other to this mass transit very, very smoothly.
Right.
Now we're running into more difficulty because they're working on areas that are closer to higher economic suburbs.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very easy thing, I think, to get people to ride mass transit, and that's to stop building more roads. And I would be considered a heretic in my town for saying that, because the Circle Highway that goes around the Twin Cities is three lanes in most places and only two near where I live. And so people are campaigning all the time to get that extra lane put on there, to take care of all the congestion that occurs there. And they're now building west of where I live, one more suburb out, and so the number of cars on all of the roads that I drive are just increasing incredibly. So I
can't get at the issue of transportation by just saying, let's not build another highway.
No, and the politics are all for building another highway.
You've got to get to issue of land use, because land use is what dictates the type of transportation you have, which means we've got to educate folks to preserving spaces.
Right.
Oregon is phenomenal in terms of the directions they've gone. Portland metropolitan area,
yeah.
Got urban growth boundaries, they're now building more freeways, building light rail, they're going to have 1 million more people in 20 years. People are talking about not expanding the urban growth boundary. I mean, people are dead serious about, don't make it bigger, put us closer together, and that's what it's going to take.
But are they serious about curbing population? Excuse me, there's the real issue right there. I mean, why aren't we doing more about that kind of training so that people aren't, just out of control?
Well, you make a place so neat to want to be, and people go there.
Yeah, part of it is simply a lot of people who sort of look at issues in American culture think, you know, we have too many people in cities, and what we need to get them is out to the country. And in fact, I think what we need is to get more people into the cities. We need greater, as you were saying, greater urban densities. And you can get greater urban densities with the kinds of urban design that people are talking about. So you could have a greatly increased population in a place like Portland or Minneapolis. Is mostly single-family homes now. You could do some really interesting things in Minneapolis and increase the densities a lot, but make it a lot more communitarian place to be, and a lot more interesting place to be than the row-on-row of single-family homes would do.
I was asking, what about trucking?
Well, Dan, trucking took a lot of the business away from the railroads and has really transformed things that way. And trucking is also the major reason for the degradation of the highways, because of the great weights that the trucks carry now, especially as they get heavier and heavier and bigger and bigger, and they are allowing the double and triple trucks and that sort of thing. What does that mean?
Dinner.
Oh, dinner. Well, that seems like a good idea. Let's stop. Thanks for coming.